And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, I'm going to talk about the right wing losing its ever-loving freaking mind. That math is really a killer. They're running around screaming that taxpayers are paying thousands of dollars to GM for every Chevy Volt. Oh, well, we'll set the record straight once and for all. It's called math, people. Math. Just a little thought. Also going to talk about the war on education as it continues on the front lines there in Chicago as the profiteers push for more charter schools while underfunding public schools. This is a big deal. This is, for me, if this goes the wrong way, these teachers end up, if they lose, we all lose. The public school system of this country will go down. Mark my words. Also going to talk about voter suppression. Turns out the guy who does that Mad Money show, Jim Cramer, got a personal connection to Pennsylvania. Going to tell his story of voter suppression here in PA. You're going to want to miss that. And also the new trade numbers are in. And guess what? Another deficit. And what is that, like the 200th consecutive month in a row that we've had trade deficits with China? And you look at this trade deficit, it's the fifth month in a row that it's risen. So, you know, we've never had a surplus with them, at least since permanent normal trade relations, PNRT. But the last 5 months, it's going up. Now, the right will tell you, well, that's a sign of prosperity. We're turning around. We're buying more of their stuff. That record, $29.4 billion in July that we handed to China. And you hear the righties screaming, oh, well, we're borrowing money. Don't seem to mind us buying all of their stuff. And the reality is here, let me let you in on a little secret. Bigger trade deficits like $29.4 billion in the month of July equals higher unemployment. That means those are jobs that we're not doing. And you look at the report from the Economic Policy Institute that showed that our trade gap with China has cost us about 662,000 jobs between 2008 and 2011. You expand that from 2001 to 2011, you're talking 2.7 million jobs gone, bye, vanished, disappeared, and oh, by the way, thanks for the profit. And we need more trade agreements. According to Condi, we have China's signing hundreds of trade agreements, not thinking about, or I think 33, she said, not taking into account that we've got trade agreements with a lot of countries. It blows the mind. Also, we're going to take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Well, today, 9/11, and I guess the one good thing that you can say about today is both the Romney and Obama camps refrained from running negative ads. As far as I can tell, there have been none by the campaigns. I don't know about the super PACs, but a little reprieve for one day from being barraged with hate and sputum, and especially on the right. I mean, all of this this vitriol, all of this anger and this hatred towards the black guy in the White House, just mind-blowing. But look, they've got tons of money. They've got tons of money to throw at this. And we're going to see more and more and more coming. And the question that I got on today, on September 11th, you know, are we safer today than we were during the George Bush years? I mean, Bush ran around as president saying, I'll keep you safe. His little brother, Jeb, came around and said, well, George kept you safe, except for that day in September, except for 11 years ago today. For the most part, all kept us safe. Forget about that day. And you look at the Romney camp, and again, I've said it a number of times, I don't want Romney as commander-in-chief. I don't want him as the global representative of this country. I don't even want him running around telling people he's an American tourist, let alone president of the United States, after what he did on his foreign policy disaster tour. To me, you go to MI6 and you issue a press release, that's just mind-blowing. Why you would do something stupid like that, it is what it is. And then you go to one of our closest allies and you insult them during the time of great national pride. Not really a good messaging tool, but I guess it is what it is. And fortunately for me, who I don't want to see Romney become president. I don't. I don't want the Republicans having power. I've been quite honest about that up front because I know their policies are destructive. Their policies are the ones that got us here. But I listened to one of Romney's aides, a guy named Robert O'Brien, and had a very interesting quote to the people at BuzzFeed. You know, he was talking about, you know, Obama's out on the campaign trail talking about foreign policy, talking about, hey, we've got the foreign policy stuff, we've got the national security stuff down, we haven't had any attacks, we've done all these things. And look, touting his experience and the time that he's been in the White House, and oh, by the way, no attacks, just a thought. So Robert O'Brien goes and says, it doesn't surprise me that they're raising foreign policy because it's another distraction from the administration's economic record. He says they're going from one shiny thing to the next. And I'm going, well, wait a second, hold on. The shiny thing, you mean war? You mean national security? You mean the thing that your guy, Romney, didn't bother to mention in his national speech, in his acceptance speech, didn't mention the troops, didn't mention Afghanistan, none of that? You mean that shiny thing? The thing that the Romney surrogates have said he's going to ignore for the first 100 days because he thinks that somehow he's got it in his head that Reagan did that back in the 80s? Understand, folks, you know, this isn't a single-focus job. So when his surrogates are saying, well, Romney's going to take power and, well, yeah, that foreign policy can wait for the first 100 days. We're going to do other things. That should be concerning of all of us. Because when you turn your head, when you look away, as we saw happen during the Bush years, look what happened today, 11 years ago. So today, and you got to love this, that, you know, they sent out their surrogates. Most of them just crazy. Yesterday, you had Dick Cheney running around talking about Obama not paying enough attention to the presidential daily briefings. Let me say that again. Because I think it's kind of funny. No, I shouldn't say funny. That's the wrong word. I think it's kind of ironic when you've got Dick Cheney saying that Obama is not paying enough attention to the presidential daily briefings. Because evidently he prefers to read the daily briefings. You know, when they come to him, he actually reads them. And they don't have to be 2 pages long. If you remember, during the Bush years, the daily briefings had to have pictures and had to be, you know, 2 pages long. And it had to have pop-ups. You had to make it interesting. Because if anybody, and I'm sure someone remembers the August 6th presidential daily briefing. Does this date sound familiar? August 6th, 2001. You know, a little over a month before the planes hit the towers. He got it. Well, I don't know if he read it, but he got it. He got this presidential daily briefing titled Bin Laden Determined to Strike in U.S., which read, and I'll read part of it because I think everyone needs to know it. They wrote, clandestine foreign governments and media reports indicate Bin Laden, since 1997, wanted to conduct terrorist attacks in the U.S. Bin Laden implied in U.S. television interviews in 97 and 98 that his followers would follow the example of World Trade Center bomber Ramzi Youssef and bring the fight to America. It goes on to say the FBI since that time indicates patterns of suspicion. Suspicious activity, I'll say it, damn it, one way or another, in this country consistent with preparations for hijacking or other types of attacks, including recent surveillance of federal buildings in New York. So he didn't bother reading that because it also went into, and I love the part where he says, well, we never knew that they would ever use planes, except when he was in the country of Georgia, they moved him somewhere else because, oh, there was a threat that someone might fly a plane into his hotel. But never mind. That's all facts. Don't talk about that. The Washington Post wrote, the day after getting that briefing, the August 6th presidential daily briefing, what did George do? Well, George was on vacation at his ranch. And they wrote, he seemed carefree as he spoke about the books he was reading, the work he was doing on his nearby ranch, his love of hot weather jogging, his golf game, and his 55th birthday. That's what was important. Now, if I remember, one of the books was like the history of salt or something like that. You go, really, George? You're not reading a two-page presidential daily briefing. You're not reading what every president in the past still reads to this day. You're not reading that. But you're going to read the history of salt? Not getting it. And the reality is it's been widely reported that George Tenet, who was the head of the CIA at the time, had on at least two separate occasions warned Bush that, hey, you know what? These briefings say that there's a threat coming. There's something coming. Be prepared. So what do we do? How is prepared? Well, prepared. And I love this because I remember seeing the special on the National Geographic Channel with George Shrub, where he said, look, you know, I don't want to blame anybody. Didn't want to blame the intelligence community because, you know, hey, you know, they failed to predict the attacks. You know, he says, quote, at some point in time, in the immediate aftermath of the attacks, I thought about, why didn't we know this? And you go, wait a minute, we did. You just didn't read it. So I find it hysterical that you've got Cheney running around saying that Obama's not participating in these briefings. I just, maybe it's just me. Maybe I'm the one who hasn't forgotten. Because, you know, what we're doing is we're rewriting history right before our very eyes. They are rewriting this. And, well, you know, it wasn't, you know, Obama who gave the order. It was all of us who gave the order. No, it was Obama who did it. He gave the order, and it was our military that went and took out and did the deed. I don't think he's ever been clearer about that than he's been the last couple of weeks, from the very beginning, actually. If you remember the speech, our soldiers went and did it. I gave the order. They did it. I don't know where Cheney's getting this stuff. But I got to be honest, I remember, and I think we all remember where we were on September 11th. I think we all knew where we were that day 11 years ago. And for me, it was the realization that this country would be changed forever and we would be forever trying to defend our civil liberties. And I still remember the Patriot Act and the fight that went over that and the League of Women Voters who had a panel. And I'll never, to the day I die, I'll never forget this. They had three people who were in favor of it, three people who were against it. Anybody want to wager a guess on which people actually read the law? Because there were three law professors who were against it, who actually read every page of it. And the three people who were in favor of it read the GOP talking points and were quite admitting of it. We're very happy to explain it to the crowd. Well, we don't really know what's in it, but this is what they tell us. So we're in favor of that. And I remember the crowd. We just want to be safe. I'm going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show. Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. So yesterday we talked about the Latimer Massacre. 115 years ago yesterday, you had striking miners walking peacefully up north from Allentown, up to the collieries up north where they were met by sheriff's deputies, about 100 of them with brand new Winchester rifles. 19 of them shot dead in the middle of the street, unarmed, most of them in the back. And, you know, this Sunday there's going to be a old-time radio hour by the guest Bill Bachman, who was our guest yesterday, 3 o'clock at the Dietrich Theater up in Tunkhannock. So if you've got time, go check that out. Got an email from Andy, though, and he was saying, you know, it's amazing how this has been completely, completely wiped from the consciousness of the American people. In fact, labor history in general, completely stripped from the textbooks, any struggles of working people in this country, gone. And he points out that he had never heard of the Latimer Massacre, even though his grandparents were married in Wilkes-Barre. His grandfather was actually a coal miner a little bit after in 1911. But, you know, quickly got out of the mines, went to be exploited, as Andy points out in his email, in the factories of New Jersey. And, you know, the reality is our history, as Andy points out, is very selective. Choosing to promote harmony and class unity and the glorification of the 1% over, well, you and me. And what are we hearing right now? We're hearing time and time again, oh, we're a classless society. Unions are a thing of the past. All that bad stuff, that violence, all that, that happened years ago. But I looked today, there was a hearing over here at the Capitol at workplace violence. And you go, we should be passing laws, making things, well, safer. And yet we haven't, which is why I've asked one of the folks who testified, Paula Stellabot. She's a critical care registered nurse. She's been doing that for the past 33 years. She testified over at the Capitol on workplace violence. Paula, thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So what was the testimony? What was the ask of our representatives?
Well, we each gave stories of different situations in our various hospitals. And they're trying to decide whether to, you know, make the case for this bill. We try to explain how day-to-day it is for nurses there, you know, especially with the economy changing. People are stressed. You know, things happen, and nurses are getting hurt.
Now, nurses, you know, because, you know, when I think of a nurse, I think I was in the hospital not too long ago. I think of the nurse that, you know, came and took care of me. I can't imagine that there's much violence that goes on in a setting like that, or am I wrong?
Yeah, well, it's increasing. It's generally what you see is in emergency rooms and psychiatric right. units. The nurse that sat beside me told a story of how she was tending to a psychiatric patient. The next thing she knows, she woke up and was being treated herself. She had been beaten in the back of the head by the patient until she was unconscious, and now she has a partial seizure disorder from that.
Wow.
So, you know, there's a lot of stories out there. Emergency rooms, Western Psych, they gave statistics that they have an assault almost every day there from patients. So, it's, you know, one of the examples I told, which is in a unit that you're surprised about, is we had a labor and delivery, a patient who smoked bath salts right on the unit that the staff didn't know, and she just went berserk right there. And that's an area where you would not expect violence.
No, I wouldn't expect that at all, and especially with you know, newborns right there.
Right.
I mean, that could have turned fatal.
Oh, that was. They said they'd never seen anything like it. She just was totally bizarre. They had no clue, you know. And then when they call for help, you know, management's a little hesitant to show up. You know, security's, you know, they don't you know, respond like we want. So it gets pretty scary.
Yeah, I mean, I had talked to a nurse not too long ago. Who worked in one of our prisons. And the story she told, much the same thing, that, you know, due to cuts, you know, security wasn't as tight as it could be. And sometimes you were left in a situation where, you know, it could have gotten hairy. And they were trying to replace these nurses with scabs. And, you know, you go, this is just a bad situation all around.
Absolutely.
And the employers should be the ones being held responsible because, after all, that's supposed to be their business, right?
Yeah, well, they tend to almost want to keep it quiet because the basis for everything now for reimbursements is patient satisfaction scores. So, you know, you don't always want these stories getting out. You know, they like to keep it quiet. They don't want to spend the money for more security, maybe a metal detector, you know, wands for, you know, like in the psych units, you have to let the visitors in. And they were telling today, the Western Psych Hospital, where 6 months ago, this past Saturday, they had an employee killed. They really haven't done much to improve their situation over there. They haven't made many changes. And that, to me, that's really frightening. When you have something that obvious in your facility and you're not jumping on it, you know, that's pretty scary.
Well, maybe they're going on the lightning never strikes in the same place twice theory. It's happened here where, you know, I remember the movie The World According to Garp, where the plane flew into the house and he goes, we'll take it because that'll never happen again.
Yeah.
Could that be part of it, or is it just that, well, there's a lack of concern, a lack of caring, a lack of willingness to do anything because it's gonna cost a couple of bucks.
We had a representative there from the hospital association today. You know, they won't say that it's about money, but he just said, well, I feel like that's just something that should be done, shouldn't be legislated. It's something that should just be done between management and labor. You know, well, that's all well and good if you have that kind of relationship, but you know, the reason we got it organized at Altoona is because we didn't have that kind of relationship. So, you know, you can't just say something like that. You know, we're not asking to mandate everybody has to have metal detectors, everybody has to have beefed up security. What we're asking for is a general blanket policy where you have to have a violence committee. You meet regularly. You define what workplace violence is. You have union members on the committee. You know, just general things like that we want mandated.
Yeah, and to raise awareness. I mean,
exactly.
Because, you know, and I look at this, and you know, I got to be honest, Paula. I'm one of these people who I prefer, instead of legislating, being able to work things out at the job site. You know, this is part of what you negotiate over. This is part of why workers become members of unions, which is why you organize, so you have that say on the job. But here's the problem. When you're looking at as big as the industry as the healthcare industry is, the bad actors are going to be the ones who are going to be able to take market share, to be able to pull everybody else down.
Right.
Which is why you need legislation to put a floor under our feet. And I don't think, you know, in what you've said in this, I think it's House Bill 1992 that you're talking about.
Yes.
I don't think having committees and talking about how to keep workers safe is that big of a challenge or that costly of a challenge.
Right. No, not at all. And that's what we try to impress upon them. So, you know, they pretty much decided that it's going to take more. They want to hear the chairman of the committee wants some statistics on how frequently this happens. And unfortunately, it's one of those things that doesn't get reported.
Right.
Or if it gets reported, it doesn't seem to go anywhere. So,
because I was going to ask you, are there any databases out there that would say, you know, which hospitals have these problems? I know the hospital where I live in Carlisle having a bunch of problems because, well, they're not treating people, and there's a whole bunch of stuff going on there. But are there any databases that track this stuff? Is there anybody paying attention, any watchdog, or is this one of these things that's kind of slipped under the radar?
Well, from what I heard today, the main group of people tracking this is the Emergency Room Association, the Emergency Room Nurses Association. Apparently, they are kind of leading the charge here on collecting data. So one of the girls that spoke today was pretty well involved with that, and she's from PASNAP. I guess they've been working closely with this bill. And then I'm with SEIU, and we spoke to the author of the bill today and told him that we would certainly be willing to help, you know, with some writing, some tweaking, you know, to help whatever we can do to get this through. So at least, like we said, we realize that all facilities are different. Some are small, some are, you know, inner city. You can't have everybody's not going to need the same.
Right. I mean, you've got to gauge your level of risk and take appropriate action.
Exactly. Everybody should at least have a committee and have everybody at the table and just look out, you know, what's best for everybody. Because anytime the nurse is in danger, the other patients are also in danger.
Absolutely. So. And you know what's sad is, you know, and I guess that's just another reminder of the world that we currently live in where, you know, the hospitals. Now you got to worry if somebody's going to go crazy in a hospital.
Exactly.
Or you're going to have violence in the hospitals.
And that's what we were trying to say today. You know, things are changing. They said, well, this wouldn't happen in a rural area. Well, you don't know. The economy's bad. You may live in a rural area and, you know, the middle class is shrinking. You know, the rural area, anything can happen. Anything can happen anywhere. Somebody may be told they lost their job or you know, they got bad news in the hospital. You don't know what people are dealing with when they walk in anymore.
Yeah, and you know the reality is the pay-or-tie healthcare system we've got now. You know, what if you don't have the insurance? What if you can't afford it? You know, this is a horrible scenario. So what do we ask people to do? I mean, we want our hospitals to be safe. We want our nurses to be able to go to work and not have to worry about violence. What do we do?
Well, I would just say, first of all, you support any healthcare worker. Again, this isn't just nurses. It's anybody that works in a hospital. There's mental health workers. There's ER techs and surgery techs. But you know, contact your legislators, you know, tell them that you're concerned about the healthcare workers. You want things to be safe. Because like I said, if things are deteriorating in the facility, and we do get some metal detectors, or we do get an improved hospital police force, that benefits everybody.
Absolutely.
You know, patients, visitors, and the staff. So I think anything we do inside any of these facilities is going to benefit everybody.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, if you're like I was, I've been in the hospital a couple of times over the last several months. And, you know, the last thing I want to do while I'm on the mend is worry, you know, is something going to go awry?
Right. And you want a quick response. I mean, that's what the story that I told today about the patient we had in labor and delivery with the bath salts. You know, that girl, because it wasn't taken as seriously as the nurses thought, you know, there was a delay in response time. This woman was able to get out in the hall. She was running into other patients' rooms. You know, you've got a newborn nursery there that they were able to lock down. You know, I don't want to be laying sick in a bed and have somebody carrying on. I mean, it would have to be terribly unnerving even just to hear that. So you would like to have one of the things we talked about at our facility is a program where you announce overhead, like a code green or whatever you want to call it. Certain group of people are trained on how to respond to these kind of situations. So this group is trained to come in and diffuse a situation, not, you know, do anything to make it worse. So
right.
there's a lot of options there that we didn't feel would cost a lot of money, you know.
But even if it does cost a little bit of money, I would think the and I guess this is one of those dollar cost average things. They're
right.
they're weighing the insurance options of, well, if you, as you, Paula Stellabot, if you get killed on the job, it's going to cost us $1 million to pay your family off. Mm-hmm. But we're going to save, you know, $100,000 over 10
exactly.
years. You know, it's worth your life. And for
and they
me,
they did discuss that today about, you know, what about the workman's comp issue. So there was some discussions about that too. It's fairly complicated when you get all the players in the room, but, you know, right now the committee chair wants to get more data on how frequent this is and where it's happening. But, you know, we just don't think it's too much to ask to have committees.
I don't think it is. I don't think it is either. I think, you know, and I would probably go a lot farther than just asking, can we sit down and talk about it? I would actually put some teeth in it. You know, maybe even some tax subsidies, maybe help out a little bit. Say, you know what, if you do this stuff, you know, maybe we'll sweeten the pot a bit to make sure that we keep workers safe.
Right. And that's, you know, and that's the other thing. You know, people, you know, you want to attract people to the career. You know, you don't want to scare them off by saying, well, geez, you might come into work here and get beat up, you know.
Yeah, you want the best and brightest. I mean,
I
don't want the one who finished last in their class jabbing me in the arm with the needle.
Right, it's somebody who's just coming because it's a job and it pays decent. So, you know, you'd like to get people in there that really want to take care of people and work with them and do the things that you were trained to do, not stand around and try to fend off or, you know, pluck weapons off of somebody or be constantly diffusing hostile situations. So.
Yeah, you couldn't pay me enough to be a prison nurse. Never, never happened.
No, that's difficult work.
Yep. Paula Stellabot, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Again, House Bill 1992. Give them a call. Give your representative a call. Say, hey, you know what? Let's protect our nurses. Let's protect the folks who take care of us. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. The working class is under attack. Get up, fight on. Stand up, fight on. Yes, we can fight on. To the death, fight on. Get up, fight on. Stand up, fight on. Yes, we can fight on. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show.
Make a statement in all good faith and say to you that there is no voter fraud in the United States and there is no voter fraud in Pennsylvania.
Pink fluffy unicorns dancing on rainbows. Pink fluffy unicorns dancing on rainbows. Pink fluffy unicorns.
I like her. I really do. You know, our Secretary of State, you know, you gotta like her, you know, because she. You know, as she said, you know, not too long ago when talking about the voter ID law.
I can't tell you the number of times I've gone to my state rep and said, gee, I really need a birth certificate for my youngest son because he's going to college and I can't find his birth certificate.
I can't tell you how many times that's happened that my youngest son goes off to college. Can't tell you how often that happens, and I lost his birth certificate. Can you believe that? Oh, can't believe it. And I look at this and I go, you know, the flippant manner that she goes off on to talking about how we're stealing votes from people. We're stealing the ability of about 9% of the registered voters in this state. About 760,000 people who have voted. These are people who have voted. Registered, went through the process, have been going to the polls, casting. Now, no. And you find out today that Jim Cramer, host of CNBC's Mad Money, he tweeted out this morning. He said, I have a problem. My dad, a vet, won't be allowed to vote in PA because he does not drive. He is elderly and can't prove his citizenship. Can't vote. Sorry. Now, you know, here's the thing. Jim Cramer, big wig, big guy, you know, moderate DLC type Democrat, got some pull. Well, what do you see? What happens? Oh, yeah, you get a U.S. congressman. Bob Brady says, you know what? We're going to, this is a travesty. Tweeted that he promised to ensure that his dad was going to get the necessary ID and the transportation to vote. Here's my problem with that. What if that was my father? What if it was my grandfather? What if it was yours? We don't have the reach of Jim Cramer. What if we're the other, one of the other 759,999 that are going to be denied the right to vote because of what the Republicans have done? And I look at, there was a piece in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette written by a professor named Jesse Allen. And she's talking about, you know, Thursday, the Supreme Court here in the state of Pennsylvania is going to hear the voter suppression appeal. And what she points out is that the basis for the decision was based on an 1869 case called Patterson versus Barlow. And what she writes, the court upheld a law requiring some voters to go through bureaucratic hassles far more inconvenient than sitting for a photo ID at a PennDOT office. She says, and the court's decision in that case is certainly relevant because it approves burdening voters to protect the election integrity, a conclusion that seems to bless the new ID requirement. So past law said, yeah, we can, some people, we can choose, we can pick and choose who it is we're going to inconvenience, who it is we're going to make jump through hoops. The decision says elections are free only to the qualified electors of the Commonwealth. The legislature must establish the means of ascertaining who are and who are not qualified to vote. She goes on to say that, you know, you read the full opinion of the Patterson case, and she says it exposes a blatant example of anti-democratic voter suppression. The exact kind that the plaintiffs in this case, the Vivette Applewhite case against the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, the exact kind of thing. She writes, the law approved in Patterson enacted a complicated set of registration procedures for Philadelphia because, you know, it had a large number of working class folks, a large number of immigrants. And also it was a simpler procedure for the rest of the state. So, you know, hard times in Philadelphia where the votes are, you know, very easy things in the rest of the state where the, well, code word, white people. She writes, equally outrageous, the law required any would-be voter who gave a hotel or boarding house as his address to go through an arduous verification process, including getting two private householders to swear that he was qualified to vote. That process effectively disenfranchised the workmen who filled the city's boarding houses at the end of the 19th century. She goes on to write, the opinion justifies the one that, you know, one they put forth, tougher processes in Philadelphia for voters who were rogues and strumpets. Because rogues and strumpets do not nightly traverse the deserted highways of the farmer. low inns, restaurants, sailors, boarding houses, and houses of ill fame do not abound in rural precincts, ready to pour out on election day their pestilent hordes. So basically, you know, you've got these vagrants, you've got these wandering Arabs, as the decision says. The Tartar hordes of the our large cities on a level with the virtuous good man. And you go, wait a second, that sounds eerily familiar to a lot of the rhetoric that I've heard recently. We're deciding who is and who isn't worthy of the ballot box. We're deciding, well, and really by poverty, by age. She points out Patterson is relevant in another way, in that it shows that a majority of Pennsylvania, of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, was once led to rationalize burdensome election procedures based on generalized and biased fears about voting fraud. Same thing we're hearing now. Even though the Commonwealth has said, you know what, there's no there. There's nothing. They've still chosen to put this massive roadblock in front of folks. People like Jim Cramer's father, who's a veteran. And as she concludes, wrenched out of context, the legal language that the Commonwealth judge chose to quote from Patterson sounds like a fair basis for upholding the new voter ID law. But in fact, the old Patterson case represents the Pennsylvania Supreme Court's shameful failure to protect elections from a law designed to make voting harder for some than for others. Now, the law should be applied equally. You know, the reason the blindfolds, I was told, is that the law is equal. And you look at how this law assistant professor over at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law points out that, you know, this decision that they've chosen to cite as the one to uphold suppressing the vote now was used to suppress the vote then. I mean, it's pretty remarkable that history continues to repeat itself. And it continues to, well, with the powers to be, with the wealth class and with their minions, well, try and suppress you and I from that magical box, that ability to change our future, that ability to rule our country, and the beautiful thing of self-governance. Because they don't believe in it. Understand. If Republicans have a chance in this election, it's only because 760,000 people were disenfranchised, and maybe Mike Turzai was right.
Voter ID, which is going to allow Governor Romney to win the state of Pennsylvania. Done.
Maybe that's what it is. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show.
Smith Show. Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
I dial it in and to the station to talk about the U.S. inflation. I understand just a little. No comprende, it's a riddle. I'm on a Mexican radio.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website there, or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program with you on the go. So the new trade numbers are in, and guess what? That's right, another deficit. You don't hear the righties much screaming about our trade deficit, do you? Not so much. And what is this, like the 150th, 200 month in a row where we've had trade deficits with China? I know as a nation, the last time as a nation we have had an overall trade surplus, which means that we have exported more than we've imported as a nation overall, not with just individual countries, was 1975. The last year as a nation we had a trade surplus. Think about that for a second. 1975 was the last time the rest of the world bought more from us than we bought from them. And you go, well, you know, Rick, our deficits are unsustainable because if we borrow money, we're unsustainable. You know what's unsustainable? Giving away your jobs. That's unsustainable. It's unsustainable trading good-paying union jobs for cheap toasters that really anymore aren't really all that cheap and don't last as long. So they are cheap, just not financially. I mean, how many people get this cheap junk from China and you go, man, it broke within a couple of minutes. It broke within a couple of days. It's garbage. And I look at this again, you know, at least the fifth month in a row that the trade deficit has gone up with China above the month prior. Now, we have not had a trade surplus with China since PNRT, since Permanent Normal Trade Relations. We haven't had anything close to it. And I can't even remember if we've ever had a trade surplus since we began trading with them. Because again, you're talking about cheap labor. We're talking about giving them the advantage, helping them. You know, that is our foreign policy after all. And I always use the quote by Paul Craig Roberts, a guy who was an assistant treasury secretary under Ronald Reagan. You know, we're the only country in the world that gives away our wealth, gives away our birthright, gives away our right for nebulous foreign policy aims. The rest of the world understands how difficult it is to be successful. They understand how difficult it is to be prosperous and wealthy. And they don't give it away. I mean, we bargain this stuff away for, well, you know, give us, you know, this missile defense, or give us this, or give us that, and you can have our jobs. That's how we've been conducting foreign policy for the last 30, 40 years. And now what we're doing with China is, you know, kind of appeasement. China's cheating. They're ripping us off blind. And the reality is I think most people get it. There was a national poll done by the folks at the Alliance for American Manufacturing that pointed out 64% of voters believe that China is their currency manipulation is costing us jobs. And as EPI pointed out, 2.7 million jobs we've lost from 2001 to 2011. 2.7 million jobs. There's a bill in the House right now, the Currency Reform for Fair Trade Act, House Resolution 639. Bipartisan. It's got enough co-sponsors to pass with a veto-proof majority right now. Difference? John Boehner not going to let it anywhere out to a vote. Not going to happen. The Republicans will not let this happen. And you go, well, why is that? Well, because they don't want that guy in the White House getting any credit for anything. It's about scorched earth. You look at our trade deficit. As a nation, we had a $42 billion trade deficit in the month of July. $42 billion. Now, to put that in context, China, 29.4 of that. I mean, you're talking about, what, $12.6 billion with the rest of the world, 29.4 with just one country? Something needs to be done. And what needs to be done first is you need to say, look, you're a currency manipulator. Treasury Secretary Geithner should be the one to do it. Should be standing up saying these people are manipulating your currency and they need to take it into the trade organization. Obama needs to stop talking about, oh, well, you know, we're going to double our exports. He needs to be talking about how we're going to dramatically lower our trade deficit, how we're going to make sure that we start building things here again. And I've said this before, you do that with tariffs. You do that with putting up barriers. But what are we talking about? We're talking about more trade agreements. They're going to say, no, tear those barriers down. We're going to tear the borders down for capital. We're going to tear the borders down for goods so that we can seek throughout the world for the cheapest labor. Because understand, Vietnam is cheap labor central right now. That's going to be the China beater. And eventually they're going to go to Africa. But right now, Vietnam, because part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. And oh, what a doozy that is going to be. And in the next hour, we're going to talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, which is being negotiated in secret. We're not allowed to know. There's about 600 lobbyists who've actually had access to the language. You and me, not allowed. But we need to be looking at how do we, instead of continually opening things up, saying, wow, swing the doors open, let that stuff come in and flood our markets. We need to be talking about how do we protect our industries. Look at the auto parts industry, for instance. You know, you want to talk about what we should be doing? There's a place to start saving jobs, because Chinese imports are targeting auto parts right now. And the Obama administration should be out there saying, you know what, we need to be taking this case to the WTO. There are rules, and you need to hold them accountable to it. But, you know, we're not. And what's frustrating to me is I look at this Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. This is going to basically outlaw the Buy American provisions that I've talked about. It's going to basically outlaw. It's going to make it illegal for the president or Congress to say things have to be made in the U.S. And I think about my right winger friends, the militia types who keep saying, well, you know, they're going to one world government. Yeah, there are a number of those folks out there. Where are they screaming about the free trade agreements? I'm not hearing it, because we really are giving up our sovereignty. And I look at the case where, you know, the company in India sued the U.S. because we have a law that says you cannot, by matter of law, market cigarettes to children. Well, they want to know why. Because evidently in India, selling cigarettes to children, perfectly legal. And good business, by the way. You know, we used to do it here. You know, you remember the Ronald Reagan commercials with him with the, I think it was Paul Mall, he was hawking with the white doctor coat on. Not a cough in a carton. That was the slogan. Made him look official. You know, he was good at playing the role. He was a good actor in his B roles. Knew how to deliver a line. That's which he did for 8 years. But I look at this and I go, you know, at some point, don't you have to? And I've had people say, you're a protectionist. And I go, yeah, I am. I'm a protectionist. I do protect my home. When I leave, I lock it. What I'm not is an isolationist. I do believe in trade. I think smart trade is the way to go. I think trade can be equally beneficial when both players are on even footing and both players know what they're getting into. And I think about trade not so much in terms of me buying things that used to be made somewhere else, but actually trading things. You know, we'll give you wheat for oil. We'll give you, you know, whatever for your trinkets. That's what trade is. All we're doing is buying stuff made in China that used to be made here. Because really, I mean, stop and think about the things you purchase every day. Where are they made? Increasingly, everything is moving to China. Because you've got this behemoth in Walmart who's pushing for that. That's what we need to be focusing on. And in the next hour, we're going to talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. Again, if you missed any portion of the program, download our podcast there at the website, therickSmithShow.com. Also, get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can always email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Stick around. Hour two right now.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Passionate about our economic liberty because I have witnessed our free enterprise system as it rewards the hard work of many and creates prosperity for all in this great country. And over the past few weeks, we've seen a frontal assault on free enterprise.
Once I made you rich enough to forget my name, in Youngstown.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. So 2.7 million jobs in the decade between 2001 and 2011 lost because of our trade policies with China, according to the Economic Policy Institute. 2.7 million. And you look at these trade agreements, which have been nothing more than pipelines to outsource jobs overseas and, of course, well, secure the wealth of our 1%. And right now, what's going on in Leesburg, Virginia, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, round 14 of the negotiations are underway. Sunday, my producer Brett was down in Leesburg, Virginia for the beginning of the talks. And, you know, the thing is you and I, we don't get to sit in the room. We don't get to know what's going on. In fact, none of our representatives really do either, which is why I've asked Ron Collins, Chief of Staff of the Communication Workers of America, to come talk with us about this Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. Ron, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
So I look at this, and again, I as I understand it, and help me if I'm wrong, but there are 600 lobbyists, special interests, whatever you want to call them, who have access to the information. People like me, people like you, not so much.
That's correct. It's a secret deal. They're not sharing it with the public. You know, the public's impacted. The 99% is impacted much more than the 1%. They're not sharing this information. They'll be making decisions and deals that will impact us and our communities, and we need to be part of those negotiations.
You know, I look at the free trade agreements that we've passed over the last, well, since Clinton passed NAFTA, and not one of them that I can point to has benefited people like me, people in my neighborhood, folks who punch a clock and work for a living. This any different?
No different at all. They will send the work to wherever they can get the cheapest labor.
So I just made a hotel reservation recently, and I think I was in India somewhere. This is going to move the call centers that I'm now using from where? From here, from India to Vietnam, where?
Yeah, probably from India, the Philippines, to Vietnam, because they can get it a little cheaper. And keep in mind that in Vietnam, people have no rights. You know, it's not like here where we do have some rights, not great rights as the labor workers in this country. But they have very little and no rights in Vietnam. Moreover, the other piece of this has to do with security. You know, the security, our information, consumers' information from this country going over to other countries. And in some countries, there's no law. If I'm a call center worker in India, let's say, there may not be a law where I could take your information and go out and sell it to someone.
Yeah, that's a scary proposition, because who are you going to go after?
Right. Who are you going to go after? We have Tim Bishop from New York introduced a call center bill here, and amazingly enough, who went full force to stop it was the Philippine government. You know, they put legislation on to try and, you know, keep the work there.
Well, I mean, as I would do, as you would do, as anybody else except the United States would do, you want to keep jobs, you want to keep your people employed, you want to keep taxes being paid, you want to keep your people working. What's wrong with us?
Yeah, that's the question. I don't think there is anything wrong with us. We want to keep the jobs here. The unemployment rate's at 8.1%. We had a dismal job report that came out on Friday, a little over 100,000 jobs. It's not able to keep up the jobs that are coming. It's not keeping up with the unemployment rate. People are underemployed. People stop looking for work. And then what happens, what people don't realize, when those jobs are shipped overseas, A, the quality of service goes down, and B, when people aren't working, it doesn't only impact that worker, it also impacts that community. It means less money for public schools. It means less money for police department, less money for fire departments, because you're losing the tax base, you're losing the tax revenue in those communities.
Yeah, you know, the thing is you talked a moment ago about Vietnam and how they have very, 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 very weak labor laws, as a lot of the countries where our jobs have been offshored. And, you know, to me, I look at trade agreements and I look at trade as an opportunity to raise conditions, and because that's how NAFTA was sold to us, if you remember right. It was sold, we're going to raise all ships. Everyone's going to do better. We're going to, the workers in Mexico are going to do better. The workers in the U.S. are going to be wealthier. Everybody's going to be happier. I look back at over NAFTA, which is the big one that everyone talks about, and it's made everybody who works for a living worse. Done a real nice job for our billionaire class that we've so happily created, though.
Yeah, that's right. It's helped the 1%, and you know, it was supposed to help people in Mexico, the NAFTA agreement. And if you went across the border, literally people were living in shacks and cardboard boxes because they weren't paying any money. It's really shameful of what they're doing to these people in these countries. And again, they will just move it to the next country, where they can get it cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, and we continue, you know, the separation between the rich and the middle class in this country continues to grow.
So let me ask you, you know, as I look at this, and to me, the trade agreements that we pursue are really all about tearing down borders for capital. We want to make sure that we have 30-foot-high fences that are electrified to keep people out. But capital, we want capital to be able to move all over the world in the blink of an eye so that, well, the wealth class can control the world. And I keep asking people, there's all that conspiracy about, one world government. What about one world corporation? What about one world investor class?
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely right. It's, if it was a level playing field, maybe it wouldn't be so bad, but it's not a level playing field, right? It doesn't, it's great to be able to make our products here and ship them overseas and take products that are made, but it's not a level playing field, right? And I see when I negotiate contracts, they continue, it's more and more difficult to negotiate contracts in this country. Because we're trying to compete with people that are making, dollars on a week, pennies on a day, right? And it's hard to compete. And it is all about the corporation. Verizon, for example, I'm negotiating the contract, involved in the negotiations at Verizon. This is a multi-billion-dollar company. They just gave their CEO a $17 million a year pay raise. Meanwhile, it's difficult for us to hold on to health care for retirees and actives. Right, it's difficult to get a pay raise. It's difficult to keep these jobs here in this country, and it's just corporate greed at its worst.
And these trade agreements, like the Trans-Pacific Free Trade Partnership Free Trade Agreement, going to probably make that so much worse because, again, these trade agreements have been a pipeline for jobs to go overseas, the ability to offshore and then bring those products back here like they're American products. As I've said, we're not talking about trading things anymore. We're just buying stuff that used to be made here.
That's right. I mean, if you go out and you try and find something made in this country, it's difficult at best. I still always look for the Made in the USA label, and it's very, very difficult to do. And we talked a little bit about NAFTA. This trade agreement, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, is NAFTA on steroids. It's much worse than NAFTA. And the impact will be for a long time. The communities will be impacted around this country if we don't get involved. And, I mentioned Saturday at the rally that, President Obama's taken a back seat here. He doesn't want to, get involved because of the election. Well, he needs to get involved, right? We heard great speeches from Charlotte last week, really, really good speeches. We heard good speeches from Tampa the week before. Lots about jobs and about the middle class. Well, these politicians, both the Republicans and the Democrats, they also need to walk the walk. All of them are talking the talk and they say all the great things, but action speaks louder than words, and they're not showing up, they're not delivering on these type of things. This Trans-Pacific Partnership, if this goes through, it's really, really going to be devastating to communities across the country, and it's going to impact the unemployment in this country.
Well, I mean, and the reality is, as you allow these companies to move overseas, they're taking the jobs and they're taking the wealth and dividing it up amongst themselves. And I look at as we've torn down borders to capital and we've given these billionaires so much, we've not been able to have any type of oversight over what's going on. And I look at this Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, the bankers, from what I understand, going to probably be able to move overseas and we're not going to be able to oversee them.
That's right. They'll be able to do that, and we'll not have any oversight. The little bit of regulation that we have in this country right now, that's not going to be relevant because they'll be operating in a foreign country.
So let me ask you, as representative of Chief of Staff of the Communication Workers of America, one of the few unions that I've seen who have really come out against this. What's the ask of your members? What is the ask of folks in our listening audience? How do we stop this? How do we fight back?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and I appreciate the opportunity to answer that. We basically need to talk about it. Being on the air here with you, talking about it, bringing some surface to this with the public. They can help by reaching out to their elected officials, reaching out to your U.S. House and your United States Senator, letting them know you're concerned about this and that you want to either stop the Trans-Pacific Partnership or at least we should be involved in the negotiations. We are going to activate our members in a couple of ways. We're going to have them make phone calls, write letters to their elected officials. We're going to have them show up at rallies. We're considering running some sort of ads and campaigns to advertisement, television, radio, print media, to bring light to this. We really, really need to get involved, and we need all unions involved. We need all citizens involved. This is not a union or non-union issue. This is an American issue, right? This is a community issue. People need to be involved to protect our communities and protect our standard of living, our middle-class standard of living.
No.
So we're asking everyone to make calls, write letters, get involved, show up at rallies, let your voice be heard, stand up and fight back.
Yeah, I mean, I look at what's going on with China, and I've heard, you know, Ron Klink, the guy who's the trade representative, said he'd love to have a trade agreement with China, a place that, you know, dumps untold bad products, the melamine and the baby food and the melamine and the dog food and all of the antifreeze and the toothpaste and all of these things that we're not catching enough of. And what bothers me is we're going to open our borders to race to the bottom policies. We're going to open our borders to countries where they have no real environmental standards or labor standards or consumer protections. And we're not going to be able to fight back because these trade agreements, well, it's the least restrictive trade barrier. So we can't enact policies. We can't have Buy American provisions. We can't not allow a company to market cigarettes to children, as the suit that I understand is going on right now from India is taking place.
Yeah, that's correct. And, you know, you made really good points. And, you know, the question is, why is the government, why is the United States government allowing this? These negotiations even to take place with all that at risk, right? You know, President Obama really needs to get involved. Hillary Clinton needs to get involved, you know, through the State Department. We need to really, if we're going to do a trade agreement, it needs to be a fair, level the playing field trade agreement that's going to protect our interests and also protect the people in those foreign countries. You know, make sure the human rights are being met over there. They don't do that. They don't care about that. It's all about being able to sell our products and bring products in. And as you say, they bring more in than they sell.
Yeah, well, our last trade surplus as a nation was 1975.
Right.
And, you know, I look at this and it's just mind-blowing that I hear the Republicans screaming about budget deficits. To me, the trade deficit is much bigger, much more important than our budget deficits. The last question I've got for you, you know, a lot of my internet friends who are really concerned about this agreement are fearful that, you know, this is going to somehow ruin what's going on the internet. I'm curious what your thoughts on the internet security are going to be with this agreement.
Yeah, I think all that could be in jeopardy, right? When these companies and these bankers and Wall Street folks, when they're over there and with the internet, right, anything could happen. We have a little bit of protection here in this country, but when things are done abroad, and you just never know. Consumers are at risk, citizens are at risk, and we can't do enough. I can't stress enough to the listeners out there tonight to stand up, fight back, and get involved.
Yep. Ron Collins, I appreciate the time. Chief of Staff of the Communication Workers of America. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye.
Let's take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
What they do, they smile in your face.
All the time they want to take your place, the backstabbers.
Backstabbers.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. You know, I look at that trade agreement, again, like all of the free trade agreements that we've pursued the last 30, since NAFTA, really. Benefiting who? Well, benefiting the big corporations, benefiting the large investors, making sure that they're taken care of, that they're secure. Well, that the risk isn't there. And I love that mentality. Well, you know, we've got the reason we have to give these low tax rates to investors. Well, you know, there's risk out there and they might lose something. But yet you look at our trade agreements and we make sure that, well, they're well protected. And we make sure that, well, you know, the laws are benefiting them. We don't seem to do much in raising workers' rights. We don't do much in raising the minimum wage. We don't seem to do much of that. but we sure know how to use trade as a foreign policy tool. Back here at home, I look at the Economic Policy Institute, which just released some numbers. The new report, the wealthiest 1% of the country, well, their net worth, 288 times as large as the median household wealth in the country of $57,000 in 2010. So, you know, the top 1% had their wealth 288 times, 288 to 1. You go back to 1962, that ratio was 125 to 1. Still had a wealth class, still had a billionaire class, still had millionaires, very, very wealthy people. Didn't have the extreme billionaires we have now, but had very wealthy people doing really, really well for themselves, but also paying taxes so that we could have roads and bridges and schools and hospitals. And hospitals that were not for profit, mind you. They were community hospitals done by you and me, we the people. Because we used to believe that we could do things better than a for-profit, self-interest, private corporation. We used to think that. We've been trained for 30 years like Pavlovian dogs to whenever we say public, whenever we say the commons, whenever we say we, we've been trained like Pavlovian dogs to get rabid. You look since 1983. Nearly three-quarters of the growth in total household wealth in this country went to the top 5%, while the bottom four-fifths actually saw their wealth decrease. And I love my right-wing friends who say, Rick, you know, you're talking about redistribution of wealth. And I go, exactly what do you think this is? What have I just laid out for you? 1962, it was 125 to 1. Right now, it's 288 to 1. They're taking more. The bottom of the economic scale in this country, the bottom four-fifths of the country, you know, the rest of us, actually saw our wealth decrease. And why is that? Well, that's because we have weak minimum wage laws, we have weak labor laws, and we've got a labor movement that has been crushed and neutered by, well, by bad law, by bad court systems that have gone after them at every chance. And you look at the fact, the result of having a weak labor movement. According to Stat Extracts, they looked at OECD numbers, the Organizations for Economic Cooperation and Development. Turns out average wages in the U.S. have fallen behind 10 other industrialized democracies who are members of the OECD. And guess what? 9 of those 10 countries that have higher wages than us, you know, the Switzerlands, the Norways, the Australias, the Luxembourgs, the Denmarks, the Netherlands, the Belgians, the Canada, the Swedens, you know, those 9 all had lower unemployment rates, considerably lower. Switzerland has a 4.3% unemployment rate. Think about that. So the right-wing argument that, you know, high wages, you know, decent minimum wage, like Australia, almost $16 an hour from their minimum wage, that somehow it hurts employment. Australia has a 5.2 unemployment rate, just so you know. $16 minimum wage. And, you know, I look at this and I go, you know, we've been fed a load of hokum, a load of bunk. And we've bought it. We've fallen down to 10th. 9 of the countries above us have higher minimum wages and lower unemployment rates. And I look at this and you go, there's where your redistribution of wealth is. We used to have one of the highest standards of living in the world. We used to have one of the highest median incomes in the world. We were the leader. We were the ones that were growing the middle class. Now, just the opposite. Because we've got a tax code that's screwed up. And understand, the Romneys of the world are going to promise you, we're going to come in and we're going to do this tax miracle. It's going to be just like the tax reform bill of 86. I'm telling you, mark it on the calendar. That's their goal. And it's the goal of some on both sides. It's the Kool-Aid that's being fed to everyone. It's the cure-all tonic that's being fed right now. We could lower rates and close those loopholes and we'll bring in more money like they did for about 6 months after the passage of the tax reform bill of 86. But you mark my words. those loopholes will come back. I'm in favor of having a very, very high top marginal rate and you incentivizing things. Saying, you know what, we're going to have the Eisenhower rate of 92%, but you know what? If you invest in plants and you invest in equipment and you invest in workers and you pay better wages and pay benefits and you use that money here, we're going to tax you lower. Because it's good for our society. It's good for our country. But we're not hearing that. I mean, some are saying we need to go back to the tax code during the Clinton years, which is a step toward the right direction. I say we go back to at least to the beginning of the Reagan years, at least. But I look at this, I go, you know, nine of the countries that have higher wages have lower unemployment rates. And I think about what's going on in this country, the fact that we can't seem to get a transportation bill passed, not here on the state level or on the national level for that matter. These are job creators. And why is it? Because we're mired in this political gamesmanship where the Republicans don't want that black guy in the White House to have any semblance of a victory. And for what? I mean, these were bipartisan things. At some point, and I'm hoping this November is when the voters go to the polls and say, you know what? Crazy people, you're going. We experimented with insanity. We gave it a try. We brought in these tea twizzlers. We brought these people in who, you know, I don't believe in government and I'm going to prove it. I don't believe government could do anything and I'm going to prove that right. I mean, really, stop and think about it. The Tea Party people who were elected, that was the platform they ran on. I'm going to destroy, I'm going to hamper, I'm going to hobble any government activity. That's why people voted for them. I mean, stop and think about it. And you wonder why we've had nothing happen. Why we're on the, almost at the cliff. You know, they keep saying the fiscal cliff's coming. Well, it's because of the inability of our elected officials to do their jobs. We should be passing higher minimum wage laws. We should be passing laws that give workers the right to organize against the organized money. You know, I was talking to a guy today who was talking, well, you know, if capital can unionize, why can't workers? Because basically that's what you're talking about, a corporation. It's a unionization of money. They've come together for a common cause to make more money. And workers come together to make a little bit more money, to have safe work conditions and, you know, better hours. You know, hours, wages, conditions, the three reasons people join unions. Simple stuff. Simple stuff. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
And take your money. All they want to do is add up and take your money.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
No other agency like the EPA, it should really be renamed the Job Killing Organization of America.
Because, brothers, it's a fact. If we take and don't put back, they'll have to pay for all we did. So let's leave some blue up above us. Let's leave some green on the ground. It's only ours tomorrow.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. A Reuters story out yesterday caught my attention, and the right-wing blogosphere who is losing their ever-loving freaking minds. According to the Reuters story, General Motors is losing $49,000 for every Chevy Volt it sells. And you go, what? That's our money. What? They're losing $49,000 of our money, according to our right-wing blogosphere friends. And again, you look at this and you go, did you not do business math? Did you miss that day of class? Evidently. That's why I've asked Daniel J. Weiss, Senior Fellow and Director of Climate Strategy at American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, the website, to come talk to us about $49,000 per car we're losing. Daniel, thanks for taking time for me.
Hi, Rick. Good to talk to you again.
So we're losing, we the taxpayers, we're losing 49 grand for every Volt
Well, you know, that argument doesn't have much charge to it. It's like saying, I lose $50,000 every year I send my son to college. What that money is represents is an investment that General Motors has made in developing and commercializing a breakthrough technology that will eventually pay off quite handsomely for General Motors as the car is, you know, becomes more popular. Already in 2012, they've sold twice as many Volts in the first 8 months this year compared to all of last year. And every month this year, they've sold more Volts than the month before. It's like with any new technology that starts out, you've got all of your sunk costs in R&D and advertising and all those things, and then you recoup them as you sell your product.
You know what it seems to me, Daniel, and as I was reading through this, and I was kind of chuckling through it, the right wing who tells me that they're the party of business, that they're they understand it, they know how to create jobs. It's ironic to me that they don't understand the simple concept of investing.
Well, you know, not only that, but what's really sad is that I have never before can recall a time when a political party or political ideology attacked an American product that's an innovative product that's new, that will hopefully find a worldwide market, that they've attacked it on ideological grounds. That's just unheard of. You know, the United States or American auto companies lost the market of hybrids to Toyota and Honda because they started developing those technologies 15 years ago, and now, you know, everyone knows, thinks of a Prius when they think of a hybrid engine.
Yep. When it should have been an EV1.
Exactly. Or, you know, some other sort of hybrid other car. So now General Motors is correcting that big mistake. They've got this innovative product. They're selling thousands a month here in the United States. They're selling some in Europe. This will continue to expand. GM will eventually, in a couple of years, recoup its investment and more. And yet, conservatives are attacking this car.
Well, do you think it has more to do with...
What did the car ever do to Rush Limbaugh?
Well, you know, maybe... Do they advertise with him? Maybe that's the problem. Maybe they don't. Maybe that's the whole point. And, you know, I remember, you know, in that vein, I remember back when the whole discussion about whether we should bail the auto industry out or not and give them loans or not. And I remember Zach Womp saying, you know, let them fail. Let them go bankrupt because Volkswagen invested in Tennessee, a right-to-work state with less wages, less health care, all of that stuff. And it was interesting to me to watch some of the Southern senators line up in favor of Volkswagen and Mercedes-Benz and a lot of these other auto companies that had built plants down there against the American car companies in their own narrow self-interest.
Yeah, it's really sad. But to me, this is even more bizarre. I mean, in that the case you just cited, it's because there were some, you know, Nissan was in Tennessee, and actually GM was in Tennessee as well. So I don't know why Zach Womp wanted that to go under. But in any event, here they're opposing an American innovation, American entrepreneurship. It's a technology that was actually developed before President Obama, or started to be developed before President Obama took office. It's not an Obama car, which I know is what they call it. You know, President Obama starting with President Bush, but then President Obama saved the American auto industry. They saved 1 out of 10 jobs in America. And, you know, now the auto industry is thriving. They've added 250,000 new workers in the last few years for American auto companies. I don't understand why they're against that.
Well, I got to be honest, the Obama car, if I were him, I would take pride in that, much as he's done with Obamacare, where he wrote on the kids' white coat, Obamacare, go Obamacare, maybe go Obama car as well. But how much of it do you think, though, Daniel, is the right's, just their hatred of alternative energy, of alternative solutions? You look at what they're trying to do with Solyndra, and I know in Congress they're going to introduce the No More Solyndras Act, which is basically going to say we're not going to invest in any renewable energy ever again because, well, we believe in oil and coal and all of that stuff.
You know, again, that just seems to me to be very politically short-sighted because if you look at young people today, and the young people today are going to be the middle-aged people of tomorrow, as you and I have learned so quickly, that this is something that they're going to be interested in doing. These are kids who grew up recycling. They're going to want to get electricity from wind or the sun. And having a party that is actually opposed to these, again, American innovations. We invented solar panels. You know, that's an American idea.
And we lost that.
And so, you know, having a party that's opposed to a technology seems to me to make little sense for that party, particularly when it's wedded to an old, dirty technology, oil, and an interest group that's one of the least popular in America, because every time people fill up at the pump, they remember how little they like oil companies.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I mean, the messaging has been, well, it's Obama who's raised the gas prices, even though he's the last guy who really has any control over what the gas price is going to be.
Well, in fact, if you look at it that way, you know, gasoline prices are about 70 cents a gallon more since John Boehner became speaker.
So, excellent,
you know,
point.
If you want to, you can play that game. So in the less than 2 years that John Boehner has been speaker, gas prices are up 25%.
You know, I think you're right, though. The next generation, my children, they look at things a lot differently than even my generation does. My daughter, who's a 10-year-old, we put solar panels on our house last year, and, you know, she's looking all over the place. You know, why don't they have them on the mall? Why don't they have them on the Walmarts? Why don't? Because they've got them at her school. They've got a huge solar array in the Carlisle School District that, sends that message. This is what we should be doing. And for me, I thought Obama should have been doing that, put the solar panels on the White House the way Carter did, and do more visible stuff so that, you know, people see that, you know, we're moving in a different direction.
Yeah, although I think, I don't know what was the reasoning behind why they didn't do it at the White House. But in fact, President Obama has put out an executive order requiring agencies to dramatically reduce their energy use and their carbon pollution, and that's underway. Agencies now have plans and are beginning to implement them, so they will use a lot less energy in the coming years, which will actually save the taxpayers money as well as reducing pollution.
Now, let me ask you, let's go back to the Volt for a second, Daniel Weiss, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org. He's also the director of their climate strategy. And going back to the Volt, I've got friends who say, I'd love to have one, but they're difficult. We don't have charging stations yet. We don't have the infrastructure built. Do you see a movement towards getting us the ability to where it's more convenient? As it is with a car, you just pull into a gas station, you fill up, they're almost everywhere. Do you see us moving towards a better infrastructure to support something like the Volt so that there would be more car sales?
There's no question that we need to invest more in infrastructure for electric vehicles. Now, part of the good news is most people have an outlet in their house to recharge a plug-in hybrid overnight, but it's not as fast as having a charging station. That being said, interestingly enough, the U.S. Capitol, just agreed to put a charging station on both the House and Senate side of the Capitol. So those legislators and their staff that have electric vehicles or plug-in hybrids can recharge them. Interestingly enough, despite what you hear from Rush Limbaugh and others of his ilk, there's bipartisan legislation in both the House and Senate that would create a race to the top for communities that wanted to invest in public recharging infrastructure. And, you know, this is legislation that President Obama's endorsed. The lead sponsor in the Senate is Lamar Alexander, a conservative from Tennessee. In the House, the lead sponsor is Judy Biggert, a Republican conservative from Illinois. It's a good idea. Let's invest money in some infrastructure for recharging so people will have more confidence when they drive their vehicles. Now, as you know, the beauty of the Volt is it has both an electric motor, but also has a small gasoline tank. So when you're out of charge, you switch over to gasoline.
Right.
And so that makes it an ideal commuting car. Having more recharging stations means that people will be able to use more electricity and less gasoline, saving more oil and reducing more pollution.
For those who may not know, what would a recharging station look like? I mean, is this something that an entrepreneurial gas station owner could put on his station lot? I mean, you've got gas stations already. Is this something you could incorporate where you'd have both, or would there be a danger there?
Nope, you could have both. In fact, I pass a hotel on my way home from work that has just put in two electric vehicle charging stations. It costs about $2,000, and it looks like about the size of one of those old air hose pumps. It's a little bit different, obviously. It's a much more sophisticated equipment,
right.
But it takes up about that much room, and it has a plug that is attached to the charging station, and it can charge a car in a couple hours.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. How long does it take to charge? I mean, is this something you could almost like, you know, is it something like you could pull up to the gas station, you plug it in for a couple minutes, and zoom, you go away, or anything like
no,
that?
No, it takes a couple hours to get a full charge. But if you were using your regular house outlet, it would take like 5 or 6 hours. So it's much quicker. But say, there's no reason why you can't have a parking garage with a recharging station. So as your car is parked there for 1 or 2 hours, it gets a charge.
Right.
When I was in Las Vegas at the Aria Hotel last year for our annual Clean Energy Summit with Senator Reid of Nevada, the Aria has recharging stations now for plug-in hybrid electric vehicles and 100% electric vehicles.
Well, that's fantastic. So,
and they're really cheap. They cost like about the fastest charging one, I think, costs about a couple thousand dollars. The one that's about twice as fast as what is using your house outlet costs about, I think, about $2,000, maybe a little bit less. So they're really cheap. What we need to do, though, is let's help communities plan and implement charging infrastructure so that people can drive their electric and plug-in hybrid vehicles knowing they can get a charge, you know, downtown or on campus or at the mall.
Yeah, see, there's the problem. Yeah, and right there's the problem. You just laid it out. You need a plan. My friends on the Republican side, they believe in the invisible hand. They don't believe in plans. Things just happen. The invisible man does it.
Well, you know, it's funny because I have an old colleague of mine who says, you know, if it's not written down, it's not a plan.
Excellent point. Last question I've got. How much would it cost? I mean, if you've owned one of these Volts, because I really don't know, and I'd love to get one. How much does it cost at these charging stations to recharge?
Well, right now, I believe that the private recharging stations that I've seen look like they're free. You know, the one at the Aria was free. I mean, no additional cost beyond whatever cost to park there. Same at the one at this hotel by my office. At the Capitol, it'll be paid for by the taxpayer. So that's good to know that, you know, some of the same congressmen and senators who are attacking this American innovation are also going to have access to recharging station that paid for by the taxpayer that enable them to recharge their electric vehicle or plug-in hybrid.
So if you need more red meat, you need more reason to be angry at Congress, we're paying for their fuel costs.
Yeah, I think a bigger outrage is that some in Congress want to repeal the same kind of health care that they're entitled to.
Yeah, excellent point. All of it is an outrage. Daniel Weiss, I appreciate the time. It's always great talking with you. Appreciate the information.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
Senior Fellow and Director of Climate Strategy at American Progress, AmericanProgress.org. Quick break, back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Not worth fighting for this man if this is the kind of spokesman he has to respond to an ad like this by citing health care in Massachusetts?
Listen, but what we're watching and witnessing here.
No, I'm serious about this.
No, I'm serious. I know you're serious.
There's no point in
you
doing your show.
I agree with you.
There's no point in us going to a convention and pushing for this man if he's employing morons like this.
Don't wreck me, bro.
I got to be honest with you. You know, the whole roof racking thing, that woman, please, someone roof rack her quickly. Please. Oh, welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. So, you know, when asked about specific tax loopholes the Romney camp would close, one of his advisors, well, you got to love it. They know how to stick to a line. Well, the campaign's laying down a number of specifics. You know, they've done that. You know, they've got policies there, the Romney-Ryan ticket, according to according to the spokesperson. You know, we've got these, we've got this stuff. Tara Wall, the woman who's, you know, the advisor to the Romney campaign, she says again, and the, you know, the specifications include policies that are pro growth in nature. So the guy who's Chris Jansen, the guy who's doing the interview, goes, well, you know, with all due respect, a pro growth policy is not specific. I mean, you know, and it's not. You know, they asked what. You know, what loopholes would you close? Where are you going to go after? Where are you going to change the tax code? How are you going to do this? And she answers, again, with more platitude, well, the other part of that is energy independence. Again, he was asking for specifics. Tell me, what loophole are you going to close? Well, energy independence. That evidently, that's part of it. She says, you know, there's an approach to energy independence. We're going to create millions of jobs. The target, 12 million jobs, Romney, Ryan, ticket. Again, you know, what are you talking about? Where's the meat? And the reality is the Romney people, they don't want to talk about what loopholes they'll close. They don't want to talk about their tax plan because as much as we may mock them about not understanding math, I think they do. I think they're keenly aware that their plan would balloon the deficit. They just can't say it. They can't be honest. They can't be, you know, like Todd Akins and say the things that he believes. And you look at... you look at the tax plan that Romney has, and you look at one of the big donors to the Romney camp, the casino magnate, Sheldon Adelson. You know, guy probably worth somewhere around $26 billion. He has pledged $100 million to Romney just to beat Obama. And it's not about really electing Romney. It's more about beating Obama. But if you look at the tax plan that Romney's got, Adelson, man, he would make out like mad. Because if you cut that top rate, cut the tax rate like they want to do, according to the fiscal reform, the director of fiscal reform, this Seth Hanlon over at the Center for American Progress Action Fund, according to him, by cutting that top tax rate, Adelson would save about $1.5 million a year on his CEO salary, on the compensation he gets just as CEO. That's not the, you know, the dividends, that's not all the other stuff. He would get to keep his low rates on the dividends. That's about another $120 million worth of dividends. Now, the Romney plan's going to maintain those special low rates on capital gains. And again, he's going to pocket a bunch of money. He's going to provide a tax windfall for an estimated $1.2 billion to Adelson's company. Because, you know, hey, you know, we need to be more business friendly because, you know, maybe Adelson will create a job or two. And they keep telling us, well, they're the business friendly folks. We believe in business. And I look at our quote of the day from one of the guys who was the co-founder of Costco, a guy named Jim Singal. He said, in Tampa last week, we heard a lot about job creators. But at our company, we recognize that job creation requires time and investment and commitment to the long term. It requires companies that plant and grow, not executives who reap and run. And the thing with the Chevy Volt, you know, is that kind of vein, that kind of mentality that we're investing in the future, investing in the good of the company, because understand, they didn't heed the warnings in the 60s when the UAW and the auto workers were saying, hey, you need to start looking at making smaller cars. These big boats are great. You know, they're fantastic money makers, but you're seeding an entire market. We need to be making more first generation cars. We need to be making more fuel efficient cars. We need to make sure that we're providing for all of the customer base. And you know what GM said? Up yours. Take you and your study and get out of here. We know what's best and look where we are. Now you say, well, then the company should go down. But what about the workers? And what the message I keep getting from the Republicans is, screw the workers. We don't care about them. If the company makes a bad decision and they go under, that's fine. But what about all the families? What about the communities? What about all of the ancillary jobs? And look, I would have loved nothing more than to tell the bankers to go pound salt. I hope you go broke and no G.I. Joe with the kung fu grip for you. But what does that mean for us as a nation? And it's easy to take these ideological stands without considering how it's going to affect us as a country, as a community, how it's going to affect workers. It's It's easy to say, well, I'd let him fail. Like Zach Womp, let him fail. Like Mitt Romney, let Detroit go bankrupt. It's easy when you're not the one who's got to look your kid in the eye and go, oh, there's no food. It's easy when you're not the one who's going to school teaching kids, 50 kids in a classroom because the tax base has sunk. And, oops, sorry, we can't afford to hire teachers. We can't afford to fix the buildings. You know, here in the area, you got in Reading, you got a school district where it snows in the classroom. Because we've got a governor who said, well, we're going to walk away from education because we need to give tax breaks to big corporations. I mean, stop and think about what we're forgoing. Think about what our tax policy has done. And when we come back in the third hour, we're going to talk about what's going on in education, the war on education, what's going on the front lines there in Chicago. You're not going to want to miss that. Of course, if you missed any portion of The Rick Smith Show, you can download the podcast there at the website, thericksmithshow.com, or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. And as always, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. We're going to take a quick break, right back for the third hour of our program. We're going to talk about education, the war. The war is underway. We're going to be right at the front lines of the battlefield. Stick around, right back after this.
Smith Show. Your proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Come all ya good workers, good news to you I'll tell. Of how the good old union has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Well, you know, that's the question. Which side in this divide do you find yourself? Do you support the teachers or do you support the privateers? Because that's what, to me, it boils down to. And there was a live survey done by McKeon and Associates that pointed out 47% of registered voters support the teachers in this strike, 39% opposed to it, 14 don't know. There's a 3.8% margin of error. But the reality is parents in the area, they support it. The politicians, not so much. And you got to look at, I saw the one tweet that said, you know, the academia in the area, the city council in the area, they're backing Rahm. But the parents, the people on the streets, that's where the power's at. And that's why I've asked Dave Stieber, a Chicago public school teacher and a member of the Chicago Teachers Union, to come talk to us about a piece he had written earlier and what's going on there in Chicago. Dave, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you very much for having me on.
You know, I look at this, and I've been saying since it began that this is the front lines of the education war. Right now, this Chicago is the most important place in education, because if privatization continues there, charters expand rapidly and wildly there, they're coming to my neighborhood.
Yeah, no doubt at all.
So earlier you wrote that, you know, because there's a lot of, I don't know if you, I'm sure you've seen it, but there's a lot of attacks against teachers, against public sector workers. And you write in your piece that, you know, teaching is a calling. It's a skill, a dedication to stand up in front of 30, sometimes more young people in a classroom and truly care and be able to teach every one of them. And I'm right there with you, because I got to be honest, I have 3 kids. I got a hard time just keeping them in line. I can't imagine what 30, 40, or like in Detroit, 55 kids in the classroom is like. And I can't imagine what being saddled with more students is doing to the profession.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely appreciate your comments, and all teachers are definitely supportive of people who are coming out, like, on our side in this. It's sad that there has to be a side. I mean, like, for us, there's nothing more offensive than when someone attacks our profession or says that we're being greedy or lazy. I mean, we have dedicated ourselves every single day to making ourselves better for our students. That's why we went into teaching, is because we want to work with and make the lives of our students better. And so, like, when someone attacks us, it's not just like, you're just, it's deeper. It's much more intrinsic. We get very upset. We try to figure out ways to, you know, express that effectively so we can actually get our point across. And so, that's just been our big struggle lately is, you know, the vast majority of people, as you said, support us. It's just because it's such a personal profession and because we care so much about our kids, like the few people who talk bad about us, that gets at us more. So we've been trying to figure out ways to kind of block that out and make sure we appreciate all the positiveness that's out there.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's the moneyed interest, because the reality is there's a ton of money to be made in education. When they finally privatize it and they weed out the undesirables and they only keep the kids that they can make money off of,
right.
That's where education is heading, in my opinion. And I noticed one of the things in that is a sticking point is this rapid expansion. I'd seen a number, something, the city wants to make 250 new charter schools while closing a bunch of public schools. You go, well, the attack on public education couldn't be more blatant, more right in your face.
Right. And I mean, the crazy thing is that, like, just the overall research shows that charter schools perform no better than public schools. And yet there's just this mass drive and mass funding to create more and more charter schools. I mean, this in CPS, this current budget that they're proposing, that we're obviously against, they're trying to get $75 million more to charter schools, another $25 million to privatization programs. And we're just looking at that as public school teachers being like, that's $100 million that you could be having to make our schools better, but yet you're experimenting on our children. And most of the time, they're largely African-American and Latino children.
Yep.
It becomes an issue of race as well into this.
Yeah, you don't see that kind of turnover, that kind of experimentation in a school where Rahm or the president would send their kids. They send them to institutions that are stable, that are well-funded, that have libraries, that have art and music education. They've got all the advantages, yet the kids in poverty, well, we're going to experiment with the latest silver bullet solution. Because when I was a kid growing up in a housing project in Cleveland, busing was the big thing. They took poor kids from one side of Cleveland, bused them to the other side, and somehow magically the bus ride was going to help them learn.
Right. I mean, and what's going on, too, like to give you an example, there was an article that just came out today about the school that Rahm sends his kids to, which is like a very elite $20,000 a year private school that has everything you could possibly want. They don't test their kids. They just do all this great kind of thing. And my school, in contrast, I teach in an area of the city on the south side that's in one of the most, I guess, poverty-stricken areas of the city. It's got a very bad reputation. However, we have great kids. But for an example, like at my school, we get a nurse on Fridays for a half day. We get a social worker 2 days a week. We have one counselor for 500 kids.
Hold on. You get a nurse for a half a day on Friday? Well, what happens if the kid gets sick on Tuesday?
You better not get sick on Tuesday.
You're kidding me, right?
No, I mean, this is what's really going on, and people don't, it's like, we're on strike, you know, and we're going after all these things. We want to make our kids' lives better, our schools better, and yet the stuff I'm telling you right now isn't being reported out there, and all they keep talking about is how we're greedy and we want more pay. But, like, when we, like, as a teacher, if you work with kids every day, you can't, like, look a kid in the eye and not, like, be offended at the way they're being treated. And, like I'm saying, like, my community, Chicago's had the most violent summer in, like, the history. And you're telling me that there's only 370 psychologists, social workers, and nurses for 400,000 students who've had the most violent summer in history. And so how is that affecting our kids that we teach every single day?
That's, wow. Yeah, and how do you justify that? How do they justify having that little of service while they're talking about, you know, opening up these new charter schools with, you know, with a whole bunch of new money? I mean, I don't get it. How do they justify it?
I mean, a lot of times they justify it. They just will find, like, you know, one charter school that is performing well. And I don't want to knock the teachers at charter schools. I know some and I respect them. And I don't want to knock teachers, but they'll find, like, one school that's got, like, some success, and they'll just talk about that school. And they'll make it to be, like, that's the key. Like, and it won't just be, like, that one school. It'll be, like, all charter schools are this great. And they use that as an example and just repeat it over and over. And eventually parents are just like, okay, that must be the best way to place to send my kids. And so while that's happening, like in my school, again, for example, we share a building with a charter school. Two blocks away is another charter school that just opened up. And my school has great graduation rates, much higher than the CPS average. Kids getting accepted to college, getting all sorts of scholarships. Our enrollment is declining because our message isn't getting out there, because Chicago Public Schools, which should be promoting our public school, is promoting the charter schools around us, even though they're not public.
Yeah, I mean, that there's nothing drives me crazier than that. Than here on the radio, this, you know, this charter school or K-12.org or whatever it is, or seeing the billboards at the ball game or on the highway, and you go, wait a second, shouldn't that money that you're wasting on airtime, shouldn't that money you're wasting on billboards be going, oh, I don't know, to educating children?
Right, exactly, exactly. And that's, I mean, that's what the heart of this comes down to in Chicago right now. It's, you know, like, we just fundamentally, teachers, 26,000 of us, 98% of that 26,000 voted to go on strike. It's the highest number in history. They tried to pass laws to make it so we couldn't strike. We blew that number out of the water. And so we're on strike because we want, like, a truly better school day, a better experience, better schools for our kids. And it's just, it's so obvious to us, but it's just, how do we get that message out there when, you know, Rahm just sits there and does press conferences and just puts his stuff out there. Our CEO, which is our superintendent of schools, they call them CEOs here, which shows their priorities. You know, he sits there and just repeats what Rahm says, and it's just people don't get to hear our side unless we go out and talk to people, which we've been doing now that we've been on strike and kind of leading up to even before the strike happened to try to avoid it. But just getting our message out there is very difficult to do.
Well, I mean, and the moneyed interests have a lot of opportunity to talk to folks, which is why I think it's so important that we have the opportunity to talk to you folks out in Chicago, because what you're going through, we're going to be going through. This is not just a Chicago thing. This is not just a Philadelphia thing. This is across the country. This is a concerted effort by the 1% to destroy compulsory public education and to make it, you know, back to the good old days of the 80s and 90s, the 1880s and 1890s, where, you know what? If you didn't have the resources, you didn't get to go to school. You went to the mines, or you went to the mill, or you went to the factory. I see us moving right back to that place, Dave.
Right, and I mean, and all this is coming from, you know, the head of Department of Education, Arne Duncan, who is from Chicago and did a lot of the experimentation that he's now doing on the country in Chicago before he left. And so a lot of these policies we've, you know, teachers have been fighting against while he was here. Now he's gone and trying to make a lot of these national, you know, with these programs that sound great, like Race to the Top and all these clever names, and you know, all these organizations that have all these, like, really positive sounding names that in reality have been doing just the opposite of that. You know, they've been making schools, like, compete for money as opposed to just giving schools money to make them successful. We have to compete for it.
Yep.
Or, you know, like, having these organizations that say they care about kids, but then all they really want to do is talk bad about public schools, public school teachers, while promoting charter schools and trying to make money off our kids and looking at them as products as opposed to people.
Yeah, I mean, it's the factory, it's the assembly line version of education. Every kid is the same. They're just little empty vessels that we're going to fill their empty heads with knowledge and stamp them out like a punch press in a mill factory. You know, but you know, here's the thing. I look at here in Harrisburg, where our studio is located.
Right.
The school district here, this is mind blowing, because here in the state of Pennsylvania, kindergarten is not mandatory by state law, which you figure it out. I can't.
Right.
The school district here is strapped for money. Our governor took $1 billion each of the last 2 years away from education. So the school district had to say, well, we're not going to transport kindergartners to public schools anymore. We're not going to provide bus service for them anymore. But by matter of law, charter school students get transportation from the school district. Think about that for a second, and the message that sends to every parent and to every person in this state, that by law, the school district has to provide for the charter schools, but not for the public schools.
Right. And I mean, we in Chicago, I mean, what you just said about, you know, that there not being enough money in the budget, that statement is repeated over and over and over. And yet, when you step back and think about it, you're thinking, one of my good friends, he always refers to a budget. He's a math teacher. He always says a budget is a political document, not a financial one. And so when you think about it like that, it's about priorities.
Absolutely.
It's not about, do you have the money or not? It's where are you putting the money that you have? And obviously in Harrisburg, as your example, in Chicago here, they're not putting it in public education. They're putting it in other places. That's where their priorities are. There's money to run the cities, but they're choosing to put it in other places.
Yeah, well, here we're giving it out to big corporations and handouts and plants that they probably would have built anyway as sweeteners. You know, and other stories that I'm seeing, and I understand that 160 of your schools don't have any libraries because, you know, why would we want kids reading in school?
Right. I mean, my school, for example, we actually do have a library. We're one of the fortunate ones. However, this is my sixth year being at the school, and 5 years ago, we actually had to cut the librarian position. So we have a nice library that no one really uses. And so we're lucky because we have a library, but it's an empty There's books in there, but it's empty of kids.
Jeez, oh man, that's just insane. Last question I've got for you. You know, I saw this story, and I've been railing on it for probably about 6 months now. In the Detroit public schools, they had a kindergarten class that was cited by the fire marshal. They had 55 kids in a kindergarten class. And one of their science classes, they had 72 kids in a class. And as a teacher, if you had 55 kids in your kindergarten class or 72 kids in a science class, can you teach them, or are you just warehousing them? Or can you even warehouse them?
Right. I mean, I think I have 2 points I want to make with that question is, I mean, one, when a lot of the policies being made in Chicago, our school board, for example, is made up of people who are appointed by the mayor who are never educators. And so while we've been negotiating for a contract, how do you explain to somebody who's been in the business world, who's a millionaire, sometimes even a billionaire in our case in Chicago, what the intricacies are day-to-day for a teacher and how that, you know, how they can impact students? And so when you can't actually explain that to the person who's on the Board of Education because they never taught, then you can't even explain to them how offensive and how wrong and how morally unjust it is to have that many kids that you mentioned in a classroom. And you would think for them as a person, they could think back to their own days of kindergarten and elementary school, and they probably had, you know, a very small number of students in there because they were fortunate enough to go to well-funded elite schools. But for, I mean, as parents, and I'm a new parent very recently, like, I'm even more offended now when I hear stories like that. Elementary schools in Chicago have very high numbers of students. I mean, that the story of Detroit is absolutely offensive and ridiculous. Should be to our entire nation.
Absolutely. So I understand class size, a big thing. The largest state in the country that doesn't have a maximum number of kids in the class?
Yeah, I mean, we're still operating under our former contract, and we're trying to obviously get a new one. But our former contract, there is language about the number of students. However, it's absolutely unenforceable, so they can put as many as they want in there. And so in elementary school, it's very common to have upwards of 40 or more in a classroom. Jeez. High school typically is a little bit lower unless you teach a special like art, music, or gym, where it's not uncommon to, again, have 40 in the class. And so we're in this new contract struggle. We're trying to get word language in there that defines how many you can have in a specific type of class, because obviously that's what's better for the kids. But they argue that it costs too much, so it's not worth it.
Well, Dave, I appreciate the time. I appreciate what you're doing out there. And tell all of the other folks that you come across, we appreciate the fight that you're waging right now, because you are fighting for education for all kids, not just kids in Chicago, but all kids in this country.
Well, thank you very much. And you are obviously helping our cause by getting our voices out there, and I just encourage you to keep doing what you're doing. So thank you very much.
Thanks so much. Dave Stieber, public school teacher from the Chicago area, also a member of the Chicago Teachers Union. Quick break, right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Or was it a shell game from the master of the cloak and dagger?
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Are you tired?
Let people do school reform in the name of school reform in a way that makes the schools bad. Us educators have a real stake in that.
It's like broken glass. You get caught before you see it. So up in arm, you're
right. So reform, they keep telling us. Well, we're going to reform the system, you know, like Bush did. They're going to destroy it is basically reform. Take money away from it and hand it over to charter schools. That's reform. And, you know, in talking with Dave Stieber, you know, look, obviously you could tell this is a guy who takes great pride in what he does. I mean, I think about the teachers that, you know, I had growing up, and I think about some of the teachers that I know who have worked in really, really high poverty areas, in violent areas. The passion, the commitment to the job. And when I hear the attacks, when I hear the right-wingers, oh, those teachers are greedy, and oh, they don't care about the kids, and all of this stuff, you go, you just want to smack some of these people sometimes. Because it takes a special kind of person to be able to stand up in front of that classroom and to control that classroom and to teach those kids and to be patient. You know, I was in with my son the other day. He's in first grade. And you know, there's 24 kids in his class, which, you know, is I think, reasonable. I'm not unhappy with the number of kids in his first grade class. The teacher had an aide and then invited, you know, parents to come in and help out because they were going to go to the computer lab and log on and take a math test. And you know, just needed someone to help, you know, go through the login process and, you know, help read certain words if they needed. And, you know, I looked around the room and there were several parents. And I go, you know, I wonder how many of the school districts that have higher poverty rates where, you know, parents are out working those two minimum wage jobs or, you know, just from dysfunctional homes where parents aren't doing that. What advantages the kids in my kids' class have over those folks? And, you know, I look at that story from Detroit, 55 kids in a kindergarten class, and it just blows my mind. 55. One teacher. And you go, that's... Well, it shows our priorities. And you look at the fact that in Harrisburg, where they're not going to be transporting kindergartners to school, what message, what perverse message does that send? And look, I understand they're in a tough spot. They don't have the tax revenue coming in. They're in a high poverty area. It isn't there, which is why the state was supposed to be there to help balance things. You need something that's going to bring things into balance, a little equilibrium like the righties love to talk about. Should we have school districts where the affluent live, where they invest huge amounts of education and get better outcomes, and have school districts that are struggling just to keep the lights on and expect them to compete on the same level? Really? I mean, are we that simplistic? And I look at this situation in Chicago. The Chicago school district where Dave came from has among the highest class size in the state. Their classes are around 40 kids, like he said, 40 students. You look at the Mattson school district, which is just right outside of Chicago. Their average class size is 16 to 23. Which school do you think, which group of kids do you think is going to do better? And I know my righty friends are, well, you know, class size doesn't mean everything. Yeah, it means a lot. It means an awful lot. And money only matters when you don't have it. So when you don't have the money for, oh, I don't know, books, you don't have the money to keep the lights on, you don't have the money to fix the roof so it doesn't snow in, you don't have the money for air conditioning when classes get so hot that they have to cancel them. And I know I had a friend of mine say, well, you know, when I was a kid, classes were hot too, and we suffered. And I love that mentality. I love that. Well, I suffered, so they should too. Yeah, how much learning did we do in those hot days? Because I remember them. How much learning do you think got done? None. But again, you know, it's all about grill and drill, man. And you look at these tests, the standardized tests, you know, he said something pretty interesting about the school Rahm sends their kids. He wrote it in his piece. We've got a link at therickssmithshow.com. He wrote it in his piece that, you know, in the school district where Rahm sends his kid, they don't do the whole standardized test thing. They don't do the constant high-stake testing because they don't want kids to get bored with education. They don't want kids to have constant, oh, I'm a failure, or constant, oh, I'm taking another test. In those schools, have small class sizes, have experiential learning, lots of hands-on stuff, lots of interaction with the teacher. That's the way you go about this. I mean, it blew my mind. They have a nurse that comes in for half a day on Fridays. Well, what happens if the kid gets sick on Tuesday? Wait till Friday to throw up? Wait till Friday? I mean, really, just a school nurse we can't afford? And you look at the schools that don't have a library. I mean, a library. I mean, think about that for a second. I mean, it's really mind-blowing. And you look at the fact that, you know, students in that district, about a quarter of the elementary schools, only a quarter, have both art and music instructors. A quarter. And you go, wow, who needs art? Who needs music? They use those things to help you learn to learn. You know, so when my daughter playing the recorder, playing Hot Cross Buns, which I had never heard of, you know, why is that important? Why is that an important educational tool? It helps her to think. It helps her to learn. It helps her to mesmerize. It helps her with coordination. There's a lot to education. We've got it in our heads that it's just about sitting down, filling a bubble in on a test. And when I was in with my first grader, you know, it was about clicking on the bubble. Make sure you click the right bubble. I mean, me, I'm like, do we really need to have computers in first grade? And I kind of understand it because that's their world now. Maybe they're not going to have to learn to write cursive. Maybe they're not going to have to learn to write at all. Everything's going to be computerized. And one of the things that, you know, kind of freaked me out, while I'm standing there, the teacher's talking about, okay, everyone, go to your office. You know, now you're in your office. Don't cheat on each other. You're in your office. Close the door behind your office and do your work in your office. And I'm going, these are six-year-olds. You're talking about an office to a six-year-old? And my wife, who, you know, who's a lot more forgiving on things than I am, you know, I'm kind of ranting about this, going, really? She's talking about an office to a sixth grader? I mean, that's really taking this idea of business-friendly education to the next level. This is really taking we're training little workers to the next level because my kid's six. You're talking about an office? Well, what if he wants to be an electrician and doesn't have an office? Now you're going to make him feel bad about himself? No, come on. We shouldn't be. And my wife's like, no, relax. And I'm going, no. There's messaging. But that's the education system that we're being pushed towards. That's where the moneyed interests are pushing us. It's all about the bottom line. It's all about business. It's all about training them to be little worker bees and not critical thinkers. And when I looked at the repetitive nature, and look, they're first graders. I get you need the repetition. But I guess it's the whole conformist nature of the whole thing, but it just is what it is. But at the end of the day, I look at what's going on in Chicago, and we'd better hope for a positive outcome for those teachers and those students. Because if they can't fight back and win and defend their public schools and make things stronger for teachers and stronger for the students and get better class size and get books into the classroom, we're all doomed. Because the wealth class will be emboldened because they've taken on the third biggest school district in the country. Which is why every night we're going to try and get somebody to get an update from there and talk about the issues that are going on there. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, Jeff Holtzman, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Touch this. Go pay the cashier. There's your sandwich. It's amazing.
Ho, 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 it's magic. You know, never believe it's not so. It's magic.
Yes, it's magic. Know. Yes, you touch the little buttons and it just... just appears. It's like poof. It's just right there. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of our program, you can download the podcast there at the website. Or if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app. You can take the program on the go. So tomorrow night, 6 p.m., the Midtown Scholar Bookstore located 1302 North 3rd Street here in Harrisburg. We're going to be putting on a free screening of the movie, We're Not Broke, the movie. I'm going to talk about, hey, you know, can we invest in education? Can we invest in roads and bridges? You know, are we really broke? Because I keep hearing that, you know, wow, we can't do these things. We can't build new roads. Can't educate our children because we don't have the money. We're broke. Yet I look at how the wealth in this country, the wealthiest country on the planet, is being divided. And I say, well, wait a second, just a thought. Maybe if we ask those who have done so wildly well to, you know, just pitch in a little bit. maybe. Maybe we could afford those things. And you look at, I look at the EPI study that just came out. The wealthiest 1% in this country have a net worth 288 times that of the median household wealth of $57,000 in 2010. That median number. People right there in the middle. And, you know, I go back to 1962 when that ratio was 125 to 1. And I can't help but think, you know, okay, well, where did that money come from? How did they expand their footprint, their bank account, their wallet, their pocket? How did they do that? Whose expense is it? Well, big part of it is the workers. Workers are working for less wages, less benefits, longer hours. But moreover, we're not investing in this nation anymore. We're not investing in education. And I know I've had so many people say, wow, we're spending all this money. Yeah, I mean, if you look at it, the rise in inflation, you look at it, the costs of doing things. Yeah, I mean, we're spending a good sum of money. It's not enough. And, you know, they throw in these big numbers. They throw out these huge numbers. And yeah, we're spending a lot of money on education. We're not spending nearly as much as we spend on war. And again, it comes back down to priorities for me. It comes back down to priorities. And policy. I mean, you look at this November, we have got an interesting choice. We can pursue the policies that have put us in this mess. We can follow Romney and go back to the Bush, you know, the Bush-Reagan policies. Or we can continue on the path that Obama's taken us on. Well, look, there's some things I'm not thrilled with. But when you're given the alternatives, man, I got to tell you, the Bush policies were horribly destructive. I'm hoping that in the second Obama term, we'll look at some labor law reform. The fact that there are 10 countries in the industrial democracies, 10 countries in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, who have higher wages than us in the U.S. And 9 of those 10 countries have lower unemployment rates. So, you know, the thing I keep hearing from my friends on the radical right is higher minimum wages equal job losses, which they can't point to any credible studies. They can't point to any actual fact. It's just an article of faith. And when I show you 9 out of 10 of these countries have lower unemployment rates, higher wages, lower unemployment rates. Why? Well, because, you know, the workers at the bottom have disposable income. They're spending that money. This is common sense. This is not, you know, you don't need a PhD in economics to figure this out. If a guy who's working at the fast food place has got enough money to, oh, I don't know, every once in a while take his girlfriend or his wife to the fast food place, fast food place does a little bit better. And so does the restaurant across the street, or so does the shop down the road, or so does the movie theater, you name it. It's good for Main Street. But we've got a party in this country that, well, they want to take us back to the days where we'll work for food isn't low enough. I mean, if you truly listen to what the Republicans are saying, during the debates, it was front and center. They don't believe in regulation. They don't believe in minimum wage. So if things get desperate enough, if they can make you desperate enough that you're going to work for a buck an hour is what the wage is going to be. And that may be fine and good for, you know, one or two people. But understand, as you're paying people at the bottom that little, everybody else is going to be taking a step back. We're no longer racing to the top. We're racing to the bottom. And when you have this kind of assault on wages, you have this kind of assault on working conditions that we're seeing ever since the Bush collapse. Employers are going after pay increases and going after pensions and going after health care because they can. And that's the amazing thing here. It's because they can. So tomorrow night, we're going to be showing at the Midtown Scholar, 1302 North 3rd Street here in Harrisburg, 6 p.m. Going to be screening the movie We're Not Broke. The director, Victoria Bruce, is going to be here talking about the movie, the making of it, you know, some of the stuff. If you want to talk to her, we're expecting a good turnout. But if you're in the area, again, 1302 North 3rd Street, here in Harrisburg. We're Not Broke, the movie. I'm anxious to see it. I'm anxious to talk to the director, and I'm anxious to talk to folks. And again, if you missed any portion of our program, thericksmithshow.com, that's the best place to go to get our podcast, or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. As always, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. And tomorrow night, 6 p.m., We're Not Broke, the movie. We're not broke. And even if you can't make it, remember, we're not broke. We'll see you tomorrow.
It's coming from the window.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide flood beneath the sway. Imperial, mysterious, infinite.